September 2008. We are at the New York State Military Museum in Saratoga Springs.
Right.
We are doing a telephone interview with Mr. Harold Lackover. Sir, for the record, would you please state your full name and your date and place of birth, please?
My name is Harold W. Lackover, L-A-C-H-O-V-E-R. I was born February 27, 1924.
Okay, and where were you born?
I was born in the Bronx. I was born in Manhattan, my grandmother's house. But we lived in the Bronx when I was born.
Okay. And did you attend school there?
Yeah, I attended the public schools in Manhattan and the Bronx. We moved once or twice, but basically until I went into the Army to live in the Bronx, we had a candy store.
Okay. Did you graduate from high school?
Yeah, I graduated from Theodore Roosevelt High School in the Bronx.
Okay, what year was that?
January 1942, 1 month after Pearl Harbor.
Okay. And did you attend college at that point?
Yes, I attended NYU downtown, the School of Commerce downtown in Washington Square. I entered it February 1942.
Okay. And when did you enter the service?
I entered the service February 1944.
Okay. Did you enlist or were you drafted?
I was drafted.
Okay. And were you drafted into the Army?
Into the Army.
Okay. And where did you go for your basic training?
I went first to Fort Dix, which was the reception center. So you took tests and they determined what part of the Army you were going to. They determined I should go to the Signal Corps. So I left Fort Dix. Then they asked me, the next thing was, I went to Camp, it was Edison, in Seagate, New Jersey. It was part of Fort Hartman.
Okay.
I took my basic training.
Okay. And what was your basic training like?
It was the usual. It was light infantry training, in a sense. You know, the Signal Corps had, I qualified on a Springfield, Oak 3, we marched through a hand grenade, but it was sort of like a smorgasbord. It was not the infantry training, which was 14 weeks. This was about 6 weeks. But at least we learned some kind of combat training. Okay?
Okay. And after your basic training, where did you go from there?
I went to another camp, part of Fort Monmouth, called Camp Wood. And there I learned the teletype machine to operate it. But I also learned the codes and everything else.
Okay. And approximately how long was that school?
That school, after the marching and training, it lasted until about August of 1944. Now, very unusual thing happened. General Marshall, who had been chief of staff, came back at that time, and he wanted a lot of men who were here for 2 years, 1944. He wanted them sent overseas. So instead of me, even though I was going to school, they put in the headquarters company at the camp board, and the men who were in the headquarters company had been there 2 years, was supposed to go overseas, that I would take their place while I was in the school. However, I don't know what happened. It was maybe they kept guys, they maybe hit him. I don't know what happened. The next thing I know, I'm pulled out of camp board, I'm sent back to Camp Edison, and I'm now with the 3130 Signal Service Battalion, who was preparing to go overseas. Okay?
Uh-huh.
That was August in 1944. It's one of those things happen to the Army, you don't know. You know what
yeah.
I mean? I don't want to talk anymore about it. Anyway, September, I'm back to Camp Edison. By the way, the whole period of time I never was in Fort Martin, except I got sick once with German measles. So they sent me to Fort Martin Hospital, but I recovered after 10 days. But anyway, then went to Camp Edison, and we were told we're going overseas.
Okay.
Yeah, and then early September, I left Camp Edison, and we bought a train, and we went to Camp Stoneham, that's in Pittsburgh, California, not Pittsburgh, PA.
Okay.
And that's about some place from San Francisco. And then it was, this is unusual, today it's a Jewish holiday, you know, Rosh Hashanah, I'm Jewish. But I left the United States, no, from Camp Stoneham. They took us down to the dock in San Francisco, and it happened to be Yom Kippur Day. That's the holiest day of the year for us.
Mm-hmm.
And but the Army don't always, like, you know, Christmas Day. So we came down, and it was a band playing for us, and we boarded a Army steamship September 15th, 1944, on a ship called the Sea Bomb, and there were 2,000 men and officers on a boat that sailed. To make the story short, the ship was an Army steamship, and not, I forget, the Henry Kaiser boat ships that were breaking apart, but this was not. And we went from there September 15th, and we were supposed to land in Oro Bay, New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
But on the way, the captain got the word, he told us that we were going to Fitzhaven, New Guinea. We went to Fitzhaven, New Guinea, and then it was the tropics. And we were lined up and ready to board, or to get off the ship. And the boat came out and told us, no, they want to Hollandia, New Guinea. It was both owned by Holland at that time,
mm-hmm.
and half of New Guinea. Finally, on October 21st, we landed in Hollandia, New Guinea, and they threw the cargo nets over the side, and we came ashore. And there we stayed. Oh, invasion of the Philippines had just occurred.
Uh-huh.
General MacArthur had just landed in Leyte and Samar. And then we stood in New Guinea. And the Army, you don't sit around, we want to do simple work, so they sent us down to the dock to load the supplies. And the only thing you could, once in a while, we'd grab a can of cocktails, you know, a can of juice to take back.
Yeah.
It's one thing you could take, that's the beer. That guy stood on top of the beer that he got when he shot. But anyway, we worked down there, and then about 10, 15 days later, we said that they told us to pack up, was out to the beach, and we spent the night on the beach. And then the next day, two LCTs came ashore, and they packed up. We went on to the LCT, and the LCT took us out to an LSD. And LSD is a landing ship dock. It
okay.
takes two LCTs inside. And they closed it up, they turned around, and we took about 6 or 7, a couple of days voyage. We had an escort, because I guess the cruisers and destroyers. And the guy told us there was only 50 of these had been built.
Uh-huh.
So as soon as they got us up to, and we landed in Duluth, in the island of Lundi, that was near the capital, Tagbogan. And it was raining, and we came ashore, and it was raining, and the trucks came down to pick us up. The captain gave us a big speech on the island, and we have to be careful if rape a Filipino girl, they're going to execute us. So the sergeant said to our sergeant, he says, please, let's get out of here. the Japanese were going to come soon and start bombing, because we were these light hands. Samoa were the only islands we had. The rest of the island was occupied by the Japanese. So anyway, they got us to a camp, and we set up the camp. Then we went the next day to, we went to the signal headquarters that was across from the MacArthur headquarters. He had a one house in Taglobin, that nice house. It was owned by a Mr. Bright, who was an American. He was interned by the chef. And then they put me to work at the signal headquarters, and I did the teletype. I said, and everything sent out was in code. The only thing that not sent out in code was the news of the day, and we like to do that. The only thing, and it was a useful thing. The only thing is, you know, I was in the Civil War, as you would say, non-combat. They bombed the Japanese every night, and bombed, but their primary target was the airport and the dock, and the shoreline that had all the supplies. For some reason, they never targeted our place, or else they would, we were up, and they didn't target his house. I was there the entire time of the war. In January, things quiet, the fighting was very bad. I got there, which was November, was the end in November. The invasion was October 21st. The November was bad, and December. And just one incident, one night the Japanese were squeezed into a corner. So they got desperate, and they charged down to the open rear in an Air Force camp. Well, that, that MacArthur usually had a fancy general headquarters guard. The guard, you know, they had fancy helmets or silver. But that night when I went to work, they called a platoon of the 24th Infantry Division, which were real fighting guys, and they guarded him that night for a couple of days until the Japanese were wiped out. And then we were working there. Oh yeah, and now there's like one incident. I said everything sent to me was in code. And you could not go into the code room. If you weren't in the code, you were cleared up. You had to be cleared by the FBI. So so they would bring out stuff to me, you know, the messages that sent out. And I noticed, and you could tell, if it was thin, it was just cold. And they accidentally put the clear in. So I took a look, I was 20 years old, and there is MacArthur saying to a general clover down in New Guinea, he needs more supplies. They always, and men for the invasion of the Philippine island of Mindoro. And the Japanese will always tap our radio signals, you know, hoping that they could break our code. But I was smart enough, you know, I had been tricked. Kept my mouth shut, and he came out. He thought he was going to drop me. He looked too good. He says, he looked at me, and he saw I was typing the code. He said, stop. The message being brought back. He didn't say nothing, and I didn't say nothing, okay? And then I kept going. And then in January was the invasion of Luzon. Now this is the army. You never know what your destiny is. So I was on a 16-man signal team. So they called up and they said, we need a signal team for the invasion of Luzon. That's the main island with the captain. I said, no. So they asked, well, what are you doing? What is our team doing? He says, they're working at Signal Headquarters here in Lady. He says, you have another team? He says, yeah. We got a team, JJ, something about a 10, 10, not good, we're going to take them. hard-working lady, and when the war ended, they took us up to Luzon, and there I was sent to the signal center in Luzon, in Manila, and there I had been promoted. I no longer did the teletype. I was a relay chief. I relayed traffic all over the world. If the radio line went bad, I had to recommute. I had to restart it to another destination.
Okay, what rank were you at that point?
When I just touched the Army, I was a T4. You know, three stripes with a T. That means I was a technician.
Okay.
I couldn't command, you know, like in Manfred drilling and all that. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in Manila, it was, you know, it was okay. And then at the end, I just don't think of anything unusual there. When I was a lady, I got a second time it happened. And a clear message was attacked. By code. And this was MacArthur. He was already in Luzon. He had left Lady. Luzon had been taken, and they were outside the capital. They were ready to march into the capital. Now I said to the general down here by the name of Gunner, he said, "I'm entering the capital soon. I want you to join me for the victory parade in Manila." You know, he had been the general there of the Philippine and American Army prior to the war, to Pearl Harbor. And he wanted a victory parade. Now, this is in the history books. The victory parade never came off. The Japanese declared it an open city, but they double-crossed it. Open city means you leave the main army, leaves them as a scattered fighter. But it ever, the Japanese fought street by street. It was a hell of a fight. So the victory parade never came off, okay? And then I say in August of war, and September, or I think, yeah, September, they flew us from Leyte to Luzon on an army plane, and there I worked. I worked in the relay center, and the capital was pretty well shot up. So that's it. And then February and January, then in 1945, we went back on a ship called the Sea Slasher, and there we were supposed to go to San Francisco. But they had trouble with the engine, so we docked outside at night of Honolulu, and they took us into the Honolulu to be repaired at the pier.
Right.
And to make the story short, we wanted to get off the ship, but the MPs were there. It was 2,000 guys that all jumped the ship.
Now, this was after the war had ended, right?
Yeah. February 1945.
It would have been 46 at that
point. Oh, 46. You got me. Yeah. War ended on 45, yeah.
All right. Let me ask you, what was your reaction when you heard about the dropping of the atomic bombs and the end of the war?
I tell you, I had a self-interest because I was surely going to be gone. I had been trained enough to go with the November invasion, 1945. We were very, you know, I had self-interest, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, to me, God damn it, the war was over. Because I would have gone in with the fight in the third wave, but I would have gone in when he came ashore, you get me? General MacArthur. The beachhead would have to be secured in the area. There's a famous picture of him getting off at the same spot that I got off.
Oh.
He was, yeah, look, he here when he landed in the Philippines. He came off the same area that I was, which was about a month early. And he said, I have retired, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was a brilliant general, but he had a tremendous ego.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Anything else?
Yes, you got to see some USO shows when the war ended?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you asked me. When I was in the Civil Corps in New York, I had a pass to, you know, for a week. I saw Oklahoma, which was the top musical show. It was very famous. And then when the war was going on, they sent a touring company of Oklahoma over. And my friend, Russell Backbauer, was the other guy on my team. He was also Jewish, so we were friendly, and he survived. And he had a Jeep. So we used to run all, every time the show played, we ran to another place to see it. And the running gag was the Japanese were still in the hills, you know. The fighting was over, but they never gave up.
Uh-huh.
So we always said that the Japanese sitting next to us, the audience,
uh-huh,
they looked like the Filipinos, you know, dark, thin, but there was a distinction. And there were other shows came over. Oh yeah, they also sent over Irving Berlin, the famous songwriter,
yeah,
that wrote God Bless America. He had an army show, and he toured Europe, and then he went with them, but then when he toured us, the Pacific, it was just the group itself.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. Anything else, young man?
Yes, when and where were you discharged?
I was discharged. I landed at Lincoln's Point Bay. I went back to Fort Dick, and the guy tried to get me to enlist. I was a T-4. He saw my specialty. He said, well, why don't you join the National Guard? He said, you'll train up in Yonkers once a month, and then you go to Cape Grump up in New York.
Yeah.
Forget where it is.
Watertown.
Right. He said, you'll become eventually a warrant officer. You wear a bar like a lieutenant, but it's called a non-ranking officer.
Right.
Like you're a technician. I said, you ain't got no more, baby. I've been overseas 16 years, but I was lucky bombing in the aircraft. I'm not gone. So I went back to NYU and went back, and then I graduated NYU.
Now, during that time, did you use the GI Bill?
Yeah. Prior to that, my father sent me to NYU, and I paid myself, you get me?
Yeah.
But then I used the GI Bill, which is the greatest bill. You know, the government's talking now about $700 million. Whether they'll get that money back or not. But the GI Bill was the greatest. They always scream, excuse me, they're going to holler, oh, they're going to blow the money. It put so many guys, unfortunately, my folks, and the tuition for the whole year at NYU was a paid school, was $500 for the year. So many guys could afford it. The government, 20 years later, was collecting higher income taxes for all those guys and women, if you were, that went to college. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that that's the benefit, yeah. And then, based on that, I went to a Brooklyn Law School where nearly any part of the tuition I paid, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I used 2 years of NYU and 3 years of Brooklyn Law School. And then I passed the bar in December 1950, and eventually I practiced law in New York. And at the near end of my career, when the times were very bad, New York City was going through the same housing situation as I was in real estate as a lawyer. But then I eventually got a job as a law secretary to a civil court judge in the Bronx, New York. I didn't live there anymore. I lived in Westchester County.
Uh-huh.
I had a nice career. And in 1990, I retired. I have a wife, a lovely wife, for 51 years.
Uh-huh.
I got three daughters. Two live in Albany, and one lives in Warwick, New York. And three grandchildren. I'm 84 years old. I got a lot of illnesses, but I'm still here.
God bless you.
I'll tell you this, I always say that. I'm plus 64. I'll tell you why. I was in the Army, I was 20 years old, or 20. So this fellow, Walter Russell Backbauer, he is Pittsburgh, he was with me, and he got a letter from his mother that said, unfortunately, this woman, she was a young married woman, her husband was killed where I was, in the island of Lady, and he was, you know your history, it was a terrible naval fight there before
yes.
I got up there. This was in October 23rd or 24th, three, 4 days after the invasion, and a fellow by the name of Weissman, he was killed there. That, Backbauer said to me, let's go down. And he said, his wife wanted a picture of his grave. So we went down one day, because we used to wait various hours. We were off that time.
Mm-hmm.
We waited for 24 hours. So we went down to the cemetery in Taglobe, the capital where we were, and we met the guy who was taking care of the cemetery. And he told us if he was killed in the battle, very early, to look at the front graves. And sure enough, we looked down the line of crosses, and we spotted the Star of David. So we went down there, and I had out a big poncho. I hated the damn thing. It was hot as hell, the army. They tested it.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, my brother said to me, I'm going to take a picture, but hide it. So he took the picture of his grave to send to his wife. But he couldn't send it back after the war because the army censored anything of a army, grave.
Right.
And only the Civil Corps had authority to take it. So that was it. So most likely after the war, his wife got it. So I look at the graves. I remember, I think it was about 23 or 24 years old. So every time I think of it, I say, plus 64,
uh-huh.
I made it, okay?
Yeah.
That's it. Anything else, young man?
Did you join any veterans organizations?
No, I never did.
Okay.
No, I never did.
And did you stay in touch with anyone you were in the service with?
Yeah. No, we were all spread out.
Yeah.
But when I was at the courthouse, I once got a call from him, Russell Backrower. And he was told me, and we talked, but I never got in touch with him again. He was in New York, but I was working at the courthouse, and we never made arrangements to meet. If I remember, he came from a quite well-off family.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Okay, and I think you probably answered this, but how do you think your time in service changed or affected your life?
Oh, it did. You know, it affected me. I mean, I was 20, you gotta remember, I used to say, I don't think I was 60 miles out of the Bronx, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Until I went into the Army, and maybe we went to, we used to like to go to Asbury Park, but we had a week off. But otherwise, all of a sudden, I'm 20 years old, I'm in the Army. Next thing I know, I'm in San Francisco. Next thing I know, I'm 36 days at sea in the Army. Next thing I know, I'm going up the convoy, and the next thing here I am, and boom, boom, boom. So it did. It has a mature look. And you know, even those who went back to school, the returning GIs, the teachers had more of a respect for them. They treat about a more mature basis.
Yes.
That's what I mean, Yeah, you had a much more mature outlook. And I can't think of anything else.
Okay, well, very much. I'm going to turn the machine off for a second.
Yeah, good.